This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Speaking of Asia. I'm Ravi Velur. In this episode, we turn our focus to the Andaman and Nicobar, which are the group of islands in the Bay of Bengal that connect India and Southeast Asia. At their southernmost point, they're less than 100 kilometers from Sumatra, and it is said you can see the lights of Singapore from there. The islands have taken on strategic significance lately, since they sit alongside the vital sea lanes connecting East Asia to West Asia and Europe. India has plans for rapid development of the islands, but this has attracted some controversy. Conservationists and anthropologists fear that the development will hurt the interests of several tribes who live in the area and wipe out their living spaces. A lot of the focus has fallen on Shompens, an isolated tribe who have lived in Great Nicobar Island for 10,000 years. To discuss this issue, I have with me Dr. Vishwajit Pandya of the Dhirubhai Ambani Institute of Information and Communication Technology, which is based in the city of Ahmedabad, Gujarat state. Dr. Pandya is one of India's foremost anthropologists, and his doctoral work at the University of Chicago was based on intense work among the tribes in the Andaman Islands. He's also someone I've known and respected for more than four decades. Welcome to Speaking of Asia, Vishwajit.
Thank you, Ravi. It's a pleasure to be back with you to talk about this topic.
Vishwajit, could you tell us a bit about your work in the Andaman Islands? How long have you known these islanders?
I came to know this island or started my work there in 1983. And since then, I have been going on and off to different parts of the island, mainly in the Andaman clusters and a little bit in Nicobar. More recently, I have started working in Nicobar, specifically with this Great Nicobar, which has been in news and as is the focus of this program also.
So it's been a 40-year association with the islands.
Yes.
The Andamans is federally administered, which means it's under central rule from New Delhi. What is India planning in the islands?
As far as we know, at the moment, Nicobar, they're planning to set up a major transshipment center in the Great Nicobar, southernmost part of it. And the rest of the island has been a focal point for tourist development. And that brings about a kind of deforestation, road and infrastructure development. And in Nicobar, particularly, it's going to wipe off significantly what was known as the United Nations declared natural heritage biosphere. Because to create a transshipment area, they will have to clear the forest, build up a port, and along with that, there's no real electrical supply, so power generation would be a main concern. It will also create silting, and this will impact in a big way the leatherback turtle population, which comes to breed at Galathea River's mouth in the southernmost part of the island of Great Nicobar. Along with that, there are some other natural species also, which are only endemic to Great Nicobar, such as the megapod is there. Plus, there is the short-tailed macaw and some of the birds, which are found only in that part of the island. But the most significant part, apart from the species, natural species, is the tribal group of Shompens and the Nicobaris who have been dislocated, who were there, but have been dislocated during the tsunami, which of course has impacted major part of the world from where you're talking. So those Nicobaris were moved out from Nicobar Islands to other parts of the Andamans, and they have been brought back, but their settlement has not been very successful. In fact, they are the ones who are very concerned with this development, that the development is not going to bring them a direct any benefit. Because along with all these economic changes, the major issue is also that all this time, the government used to say, as you rightly said, it was controlled mainly by Delhi, that it's a strategic location. Yes, indeed, it is a strategic location, and therefore the government restricted any kind of real research in that area also. And Shompens remained unstudied, or rather were never really part of a sustained research project. But now all of a sudden, the strategy is gone. And they want to develop it into a major port. I see no reason how they are balancing the arguments about defense, about which more as your interest in that area and the military growth in that part of the world. And along with that, of course, there's a major naval installation. There's a base there, which they have been developing. Now, how will that balance against the strategic importance, the defense, the opening up of the port, tourism, etc.? So it's a real mess and a blend of various things. I think it's a real mixer, you know, or a blender where things are going to be chopped up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you say that. Could you tell me how many Shumpins live on Great Nicobar?
There is no real correct estimate because there are clusters of Shumpins scattered in the middle of the island, and they go through the process of fission and fusion depending on the season. So as soon as the group is large enough, they have to separate and they start their own cultivating their small gardens. So there's a process in which, but I think the total population approximately safe count would be something in the range of 450 to 500.
And they have their own language?
Yes, indeed, they have their own language. And the other Nicobaris who have lived with and shared the island with them, they don't have any common overlaps except some vocabulary or some lingua franca which they have developed in between the Nicobaris and the Shumpins.
Interesting. Vishwajit, I do remember that in the mid-1980s, when Mr. Rajiv Gandhi was Prime Minister of India, there also were some plans to develop the island. What's different between then and today?
It's a very good question. That time, there was an idea of developing tourism, but that tourism was mainly focused on trying to do environmental tourism. But now the thing has changed into tourism, which is, you know, to develop certain kind of resorts and health resorts or people to come and rest in the coastal areas. But previously in the Rajiv Gandhi period, the concern was to people should visit it much more like in the case of Sikkim and Bhutan. A limited number of people go there. They do scuba diving or enjoy the environment and study it, or rather conservation was the major point. But now that is not the concern. Already massive number of trees have been cut up to develop the port in Great Nicobar, particularly in the southernmost part. The habitat has been destroyed badly. It's estimated nearly 5 lakh trees would be cut up.
500,000 trees?
Yeah. And sadly enough, there's a policy, which is a good policy of the government, that if you cut one tree in part A, then somewhere else that same number of tree has to be planted. But it doesn't say what kind of trees, or you don't replace the same species of the tree. So the Great Nicobar is a tropical evergreen forest. Now, they have replaced, or their policy is that they're going to plant trees in central India, which does not support evergreen forest. It's going to only grow temperate forest. Now, this is not a real wise way of approaching the situation, because remove an evergreen forest, which has been there for so many years and was the United Nations declared habitat or environmental biosphere, which was under protection. Now, you remove that and you plant temperate forest in central India, which is its own environment.
Well, India is still a developing country, and compared with even its close neighbor, Indonesia, the per capita GDP is almost only half of Indonesia's at the moment. So there's a lot of catching up to do. So I suppose there is a case to be made also for rapid development, which the country has tried to embark upon in this little window they have with the demographic dividend in their favor currently. But that aside, could you expand a little bit about the strategic significance of the islands and the reason why India wants a transshipment port there? Is it to build closer connections with Southeast Asia?
I wish it was Southeast Asia. I think the concern is about the Far East Asia, or rather the big country of China, you know, which is seen as a major threat, and the control of the sea routes there. Economics perhaps is not a very dominant or a prominent issue, because if you think of the location of Great Nicobar and the transshipment where they're going to build, there are already international ports which are quite effective. Sri Lanka has one. Then on the extreme ends also we have. Then, of course, is the Indonesia. So what major diversion of the sea traffic and the advantage it would have by bringing the ships to berth in Great Nicobar and save any big major amount of money in berthing their ships there or diverting the traffic to Great Nicobar. I don't think there has been very satisfactory argument given. I'm not a person of economics or deep analysis of that kind of statistics. But the issue was raised in the meetings when the plans were being discussed about the feasibility of doing this project in Great Nicobar. And there was no real justification given. But I'm sure people higher up in the government must have considered this issue. But why can't we hear about this?
You know? Mean it's not been published yet?
Yes, yes. Or at least I'm not aware of it.
I see. That probably adds a strategic component to it, the unspoken, the unpublished part of the plans.
Definitely. Because, see, the other major issue is you need certain amount of depth to build ports, particularly for cargo. That is only possible in one specific part of Great Nicobar, not all over the Nicobar coastal area. So that makes it a very precise location they have to do. Now, how does that figure into all the military movements which are happening in this part of the world? China is, you perhaps know more because that's your, what they call your beat, your heartbeat of interest in journalism. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. And at what cost? Yes, you know, you rightly said that we are in a developing country and we need to compete and perhaps be at par with some of the neighboring countries of ASEAN. Right, but at what cost? Those countries have also realized their loss of timber, as in the case of Indonesia, and the kind of corruption it has done. And in Indonesia now is, if my reading is correct, is very concerned about how the crops have impacted the local economy, the way to think culturally about the issue of rice. And here, we don't even have a source of water, clean source of water in Andaman and Nicobar. Means it's sad that they have boosted the tourism, but the amount of plastic water bottles which have to be moved, now there's a problem of where do you get rid of these plastic bottles. So, you know, these things have to be thought through. We should learn from our neighboring countries how they have tried to concern this. Once the environment is gone, you cannot bring it back. It is not like some other resources which can be brought back. I mean, forget the issue of champagnes. Champagne language, champagne cultures, they have successfully existed in that forest for 400 or more years. Perhaps we could think of alternative economies of tourism.
I see.
That also can be a way to think about it, which will also benefit the people, the champagnes also, and the Nicobaris.
I see. So you're not against tourism per se, but only the type of tourism that is being thought about.
Yes. I'm not against progress and economic development, but I'm saying that it has to be context-sensitive analysis of it. It has to be development for the people, defined by the people, in consultation with the people.
Could you talk a bit about the ecology of the Andamans? You did mention shortages of water. Can the area sustain a bigger population?
All islands, as far as I understand, have a limited capacity, carrying capacity. It's like environmentalists say that it's traveling in a plane. And if you overload the plane, the screws and the bolts and the wings will start loosening up while you're flying. So one has to be very careful with it. It's not like the mainland India, where if a part is destroyed, you can move a couple of miles further down. But in islands, you can't do that. And that makes it into a very... All over the world, the problem is there about the islands, the rising level of water and how it is going to impact. The same thing is true about Andaman and Nicobar. There's an acute water shortage. There's a problem of energy also. Sadly or strangely enough, there are parts of Andaman and Nicobar where they still depend on diesel-generated power. Now, diesel has to come from mainland. There's a whole series of economics involved in it.
You mentioned living with... Tribals, were they the Ongis, as I remember?
Yes, Ongis, and then I have lived with Jarwas.
With the Jarwas?
Time.
I thought the Jarwas were so-called hostile tribes.
Nobody is hostile. Hostility is something which we go and create. The Jarwas never came out. The Ongis never came out to any of the areas. We have gone and hassled them. Mm-hmm. And that is something which is very important point to think about. You know, recently... About 2 years back, John Cho was killed in Sentinels which is part of the Andaman Islands, a little close by to Nicobari clusters of the islands. And still people think about it, the say hostile sentinels. But who the sentinels didn't come to us. We went into sentinel areas. And that is a very important issue, whose hostility it is. It's like people say, you disobeyed my orders and you tried to create something which is called a rebellion. But the point is, I may be revolutionary fighting for my own rights. And that capacity to think about environment, to think about the tribes, to think about the land, has to be granted even in case of Andaman and Nicobar. And the Indians are talking about this, they are concerned about this, but I'm very happy that you have brought this over to the talk as a topic of your talk. Perhaps more people will join us in trying to resist this kind of short-sighted way of trying to think about development. I'm not saying no development, please. Environmentalists and anthropologists are often accused of being against economic development. No, I do enjoy my economic development and I'm all for it, but at least sensibly to be done.
Right. No, when I said hostile tribes, I meant the kind of reception you get when you visit them. I don't mean to attack them, for a visitor.
I'm sorry.
Just to confirm, so the so-called, as a classification, the hostile tribes would be the Jarawas and the Sentinelese on those islands?
Yes, now probably it will be only Sentinelese.
I see. To talk a bit more about the Shompens, which is what we started with, could you give me a sense of what sets them apart from the Ongis and the Jarawas?
Sure. Let's consider the issue of why the Shompens think that this proposed idea of certain kind of land which has to be cleared and the transshipment area which has to be brought in, how do they perceive this? You know, what is their argument for it? And I think that needs to be really highlighted because people talk about zoological species and, you know, endangered groups of cultural groups. But what exactly is in the cost for, what exactly would be the cost of what would be the loss for the Shompens? The Shompens organize their marriages and alliances down the stream. If you see the map of Great Nicobar, it rises in the center. And there are a lot of streams which flow out. There are three major rivers cutting, crisscrossing the Nicobar, Great Nicobar Islands. And all the marriages happen upstream. So when you go upstream, you can get all the marriage partners. But downstream, the Shompens will not take their marriages. So they will go and they will exchange their daughters down the stream. And the reason for that is upstream, the river brings the silt. And that silt deposit makes it possible for them to plant small patches of tapioca and yams, which they cultivate. That's the only thing they cultivate. There's some wild varieties of tomatoes and peppers, which they sometimes collect and bring it to the Nicobaris to trade for other items. So the soil is fertilized from top to bottom of flow of the river. Now, if you start building up the port, as they think some amount of logging did, and they resisted that, it starts silting. It starts backing up the water. It's like a bad drainage system in the apartment building. And if that happens, the soil will not fertilize. The garden's capacity to grow would subside significantly. And so would the marriage structures collapse. And that is a very important point because if you see the old historical photographs of the Shompens, they used to build their houses at least 15 to 20 feet above the ground. So practically people used to have this notion that the Shompens live in trees. It's not really living on the trees, but they used to create a security for themselves, a kind of fortification by living above the ground and remove the ladders which they used to build or scaffolds so that the people would not attack them or the neighboring other tribal groups within the Shompens would not attack each other. They used to have the custom of what they popularly in anthropology was known as marriage by capture. So one group of Shompens would attack the others to take daughters away from there. And that also meant that you then could control land. So this idea of reproduction, human reproduction and land reproduction was controlled in the flow of the river. Now, this is a way in which river is an important part, water flow is an important part of the cultural and their worldview. It's like saying people living on an island think of navigation as a very different and in a very complex way than we who living in cities and in a country where there's a roads and transport system. So I don't know how to really emphasize this much more than trying to quickly tell you something about the kinship structures and the land utilization structures among the Champans, which is distinctive from other groups on these islands.
But just to stay on the subject, I understand that the Champans share the island with the Nicobaris. But how is it there's so much focus on the Champans but not on the Nicobaris?
Because Nicobaris have had some chance to develop and be connected or in the outside world or being take some of the advantages or some of the benefits of the outside world. Champans have remained, or as the government used to administration used to say, shy Champans. You know, they remain inside the forest. They don't. But the Nicobaris have come out. The Nicobaris now are government officers. They are doctors, practitioners of various professions, lawyers. They are not the kind of tribal group which we think of as in terms of, say, Jarvas or Ongis. They are much more acculturated and have moved ahead and have their right to bargain for, and the government has made it possible for them to do it. And I compliment some of those things which have been done for the Nicobaris. But on the other hand, it has also been badly treated in some sense. The resettlement after the tsunami, some of the Nicobaris were disconnected from their traditional areas of resources, and particularly certain kind of timber which they used to build their own houses with. They cannot access those. And so their situation is very different from Champans. The amount of work and research which has gone in to understand Champans is very limited as compared to even Nicobaris.
Very interesting. What would be the average life expectancy of the Champans?
I don't know precisely how to answer that. But I, seeing the community or seeing the size of people there, just based on sheer physical appearance, I would think they generally live up to the age of about 70, 80, 75, 80.
That's in line with national statistics.
Yeah, very much.
Interesting. Vishuti, as anthropologist, let me ask you this. You know, one of the most famous anthropologists of India was Veera Elvan, and he is supposed to have seen tribals as so-called noble savages, and founding Prime Minister Nehru largely said to have bought into this view. But as you just pointed out about the Nicobaris, there's merit in saying that the state has a responsibility to bring these people out into the open and make them participate in the wider India that is developing.
Yeah, there is no issue about that. But my concern is that we must give them the right to make their own choice. That is not being done. When people say that we will provide welfare, we decide what that welfare is. We have decided that you should learn, you should go to a school where the Hindi language would be taught to them. That I have problem with that, because they should be given a chance to decide whether they want, what kind of school they want, what kind of languages in the school should be given to them. You take away everything, you take away all the furniture in their house, and then you say, well, please tell me what is comfortable life for you to sit in this hut. You at least give them a chance to make their own decision.
How is the administration responding to the concerns raised by NGOs and scholars like you?
Well, there was a time when a lot of positive response and a collaboration went on with the NGOs and the anthropologists and the government administration. But lately, in last 2 years, it's all clammed up. You know, you don't tell us, you people just, it's like exactly like I was trying to say, that I'm not against progress, but I'm saying that progress with the people and for the people, that that definition of progress has to be more inclusive. The government now has, even to 1 week, nobody's allowed to go and do any sustained work. You know, the lot of creative and constructive work was started among the tribal groups, particularly I know of Andaman, not of Nicobar so much, because I was not directly involved in it. Well, except I went in because of the Champans issue. I was brought in by the government. In fact, that also I must acknowledge that the government was at least sensitive to say that, Mr. Pandey, why don't you come and give us a report on this? You know, how feasible this idea would be and why it should be done and why it should not be done. that sensitivity was there. And I must compliment the administration that they did. But as soon as the report came out and there was nobody in support of it, immediately it was withdrawn.
But what were the salient features of the report that you handed to the administration?
We gave them some alternative locations, which were based on the map which the people drew. And therefore, we did not write a written report. We gave them a visual report because we thought that would be much more reliable, because we filmed the thing and we filmed exactly what they told us to film, including the Champins. I think I had sent you the copy of that to you, where they pointed out what they would like in the development to be done. Not the port, but some of the other issues about education, about marketing of their agricultural products and things like that. So the salient feature was that, first of all, the Champins don't want anything to disturb their water tributaries. They don't understand the magnitude and the complexity of the grid infrastructure which is being built there and which is being planned. But they are very clear about that outsiders should not enter their forest. And that is a kind of ideological stand they have had for a long time, which is one of the reasons why Champins are still in a much more healthier position, demographically or culturally speaking, as compared to, say, the Great Andamanese, who were exposed to the outside world for a long time and were very happy to embrace everything which came from the outside. Similar situation has happened with the Jarvas also. Anyway, that's not the concern of today's talk. But this idea that actually those people who have had minimum contact are much healthier and have a better future, I think, than those who have had a contact with the outside world, and they are much more in a precarious position, or what the government used to call them PVTGs, you know, or still calls them particularly vulnerable tribes. What is the vulnerability? Who defines that vulnerability? We are the people who cause the vulnerability. And therefore, that issue has to be brought out. How do we coexist, not how they exist? That is very easy to define. Inoculate them, give them rations, give them education, and everything will be fine. But you have taken away their right to think about their future. They also have a vision of future. They also have poetry. Nobody wants to talk about that. We think that they don't think, they don't imagine. They just hunt and gather. They're not that kind of people that they just get up and only thing they can think of is like beat their chest and run after some animal with bows and arrows. We at least should grant that they also have an outlook to life. They also have a vision of their world. And it's important to learn that, because the world is changing rapidly around them and we are concerned about the environment and all of those issues. But how do we learn from them the technology and their techniques to keep the environment as it is and still work and progress in it?
Thank you very much for a most stimulating and interesting conversation. And it's been nice to see you after so many years.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you. Of course, it was always very uncomfortable topics to talk with you, but that's okay. I enjoyed it.
Vishwajit, thank you so much for coming and speaking of Asia.
Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap for Speaking of Asia, a podcast series by The Straits Times. I'm Ravi Velour. Don't forget to share this podcast with your friends and family. If you'd like to read my articles, we have links in our podcast show notes below.
Send your feedback to podcast@sbh.com.sg. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or within our Straits Times app. Thanks for listening.